Welcome to the second episode of Current Topics and 5G Technology Podcast Series, hosted by Microwave Journal editors Pat Hindle and Gary LaRude. This series is sponsored by Roden Schwartz and features one of the top 5G experts in the test and measurement field, Andreas Ressler, technology manager at Roden Schwartz. And in this episode, we have a special guest, Earl Lum, president of EJL Wireless Research. Welcome, Andreas and Earl.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Pat.
In the first episode, we covered the current state of 5G rollouts, including the effects of COVID-19, plus the current challenges in 5G technology. In this episode, we're going to cover massive MIMO and millimeter wave technologies. First off, Andreas, can you kind of define for us what massive MIMO is? Because sometimes there's a confusion around that term.
Yeah, Pat, that's a very good assessment. I experienced a lot of time in conversations with customers or partners. So in my opinion, it's very important to establish a definition of the term massive MIMO. In my experience and all the conversations I had, that was very helpful to understand the problems that people are describing. So let's do that. In my eyes, let's start with the first part, massive, which is the probably easiest one. I think massive relates in this regards to the fact that we're using a large number of antenna elements in this particular transmission concept. And I think everybody can agree to that pretty quickly. But what is to me essential and often not clear to everyone is that this number, this huge number of antenna elements refers to the network side. In other words, to the base station. I mean, this number of individual elements exceeds by far the number of elements that we have on the device side. We have here a physical limitation, speaking of a traditional smartphone form factor side. And that is what typically sometimes confuses people, in my opinion. The second part of the term massive MIMO misses here the attribute multi-user MIMO, so short MIU MIMO. I think this is what people also confuse. From the LTE days, we had single-user MIMO, so there we had practically two or four spatial layers that carried independent data streams to increase the data throughput for that individual user. So that is what people know and understood over the years, and now we're coming with the term multi-user MIMO. That means just like from my point of view, that I have now multiple user using the same time and frequency resources to transmit their data. And in the terminology in the literature, that is often referred to also as a layer. Yeah. So this is the kind of situation that we are in. And these multi-user MIMO layers, these different transmission to multiple users, that's simultaneously on the same time frequency grid. So what we need for that is, of course, two users that simultaneously want to receive data. Otherwise, the whole concept wouldn't work. And this differentiation is then, of course, coming with the use of the massive array, these massive number of antenna elements to create different beams so that you can transmit towards these different users. And I think it's also important to understand from my point of view for massive MIMO that the total available power in downlink direction, because we're speaking here about downlink, is shared among these different transmissions. So that, of course, impacts the signal-to-noise ratio and overall the achievable capacity gain, which means that the more users I have this increase in capacity gain, but I also have an increase in interference created from these different users. I see a degradation in the signal-to-noise ratio based on that, and there will be a limit when these gains that I achieve are basically diminished by the power sharing and the creation of this interference. So as everywhere, there is no free lunch. There's always a trade-off. And I would say this is my definition of massive MIMO. And based on that, we maybe should call it massive multi-user MIMO to be more accurate, to distinguish between these different terms in the technology world, or if we're writing about this subject. So that's how I would define it.
Earl, what are the most popular configurations for 5G sub-6 gigahertz that are rolling out regionally?
So, Pat, from a network perspective and not from the UE perspective, where we're talking now about the number of radio channels that are physically in the active antenna unit or AAU, which is different than the number of layers that antenna system can support. In China right now is primarily focused, that country is primarily focused on 64 radio channels And again, it would be probably 190 plus antenna elements typically, because most of the radios out there are in a 3-to-1 configuration relative to the number of radios and the number of antenna elements. The US with new T-Mobile is also going to be doing a 64 transmit, 64 receive configuration for the radios that they will be deploying in New York City and Philadelphia to start as they start converting over some of the legacy Sprint markets. In South Korea and in Japan, we're looking at a 32 transmit, 32 receive, partly because of the fact that they have two-man crews over in those countries to do the deployments. And the current radios that we see for Gen 1 are roughly in the 40 to 45 kilogram weight class. And it would be very difficult for two people to carry one of these up to the top of a tower or rooftop and to get it mounted onto a pole. So they've opted for the 32. And additionally, from a horizontal beamforming as opposed to vertical beamforming, there's not really a huge requirement for the vertical at this point. And that would be the same case for Europe, where we're seeing primarily 32 as a configuration for the hotspot sectors. But the majority of the sites in Europe, I would expect, as well as the sectors, will be primarily 8x8. So now we're entering into this non-massive MIMO or massive entailment configuration where it's all about cost, it's all about coverage, and it's all about the CapEx requirements for the mobile operators in Europe. And the rest of the world right now, it kind of remains to be seen. I would imagine that at some point India, when they do start to deploy, will probably be in the 64 transmit, 64 receive category as well, just given the population densities for that particular country.
Andreas, are you seeing kind of the same thing regionally?
Yeah, I tend to agree to all. I mean, I have a specific North American scope. So for me, the Sprint and UT Mobile rollouts of massive MIMO are, of course, of interest. I think what is also valuable to understand when we use the terms 32 transmit, 32 receive, or 64 transmit, 64 receive is, like Earl pointed out, there's a serious number of antenna elements behind this. I think that's typically very vendor specific. Then also how these elements, individual elements, are organized, if they are organized in subarrays within the array, how these are controlled and such. So that has always something to do with how the vendor implements these technology. I would also like to point out that not necessarily means the more elements or the more subarrays, the better, or the more capacity you can achieve. I think there's some controversy in the industry how to utilize these radios. I think it has a lot to do with the deployment scenario. So speaking downtown New York, where you have the tall buildings, you need higher elevation possibilities to address these different UEs. And then you have, you know, urban and suburban scenarios and things like that. So all that plays a role in the selection of the radio and the transmit configuration, as far as I understand the concept. And we shouldn't forget when we discuss this under the umbrella of massive MIMO.
Andreas, what are the main test challenges for massive multi-user MIMO, as you describe it?
So as we pointed out, massive MIMO is using active antenna systems or arrays in that case. That means we need an over-the-air test setup and focusing on the validation of the performance of that system. So first of all, if massive MIMO is a critical technology component, not just in LTE, but definitely in 5G new radio, there are no specific test cases defined by the standardization organization for base station testing that cover purely massive MIMO. I think this is to protect the intellectual property of the different vendors, that the standards organization is not going into that area. But what is defined is, of course, the RF conformance requirements from a transmitter, receiver, and performance perspective. And that is what we, of course, can discuss and describe from a testing perspective. Everything else is basically tested, you know, in a lab environment or in IUDT test scenarios here. So independent from the test methodology, I see two challenges. The first challenge is the measurements itself. If we think about traditional RF measurements, like power, like signal quality in form of an error vector magnitude, these measurements have to be carried out in far field. So I need to create so-called far field conditions. There are several ways to do that, of course, but the first question is, of course, for me, what is the far field? And very high-level definition of that is, of course, the far field depends on the antenna aperture size, which we typically call D, and is estimated by the so-called Fraunhofer distance, which is 2D square over lambda. You know, in a podcast, it's really difficult to illustrate that, but if you allow me the example that we think about one of these two-pole antenna panels that usually have a height of about a meter 50, if we think about one of the carrier frequencies of 5G right now for sub-6, 3.5 gigahertz wavelength, about 8.5 centimeters, then if you put it into that approximation, you end up with a faulty distance of about 50 meters, right? So that would mean you would have a chamber that's 50 meters long, or maybe even a little bit bigger for the equipment, antennas and absorbers and such. But it's, of course, not the economy of scale to test something like that in an OTA fashion. So we need other methods. They have been established. We can do that based on software or hardware. I think the industry is following the hardware approach to the indirect far field creation using compact antenna test ranges. So these compact antenna test ranges using reflectors to create far field conditions and not too far distance from that reflector. And what that does is basically it creates a so-called plane wave, which is actually far field. And in a certain size with a certain quality, we call that the so-called quiet zone where these device under test, the antenna panel and remote radio head need to fit into. There's not many companies that can do that. Rohde & Schwarz is one of them to address this challenge. I think the second challenge is then, of course, the calibration of the setup so that you have accurate and repeatable measurement results. You can imagine we deal with a lot of factors here, the chamber itself, the positioner, the distance between the device and the measurement antenna. The measurement antenna has a gain. Then we have cables involved to connect the antenna to the test equipment. In this terms, typically a signal generator and a spectrum analyzer that is usually sitting outside the chamber. So we deal with losses everywhere, cable loss, free space path loss between the device and antenna used for testing. So the whole signal path needs to be calibrated. And that's, of course, typically automated based on the method that's been selected. And of course, RNS as a test measurement vendor is having these tools to carry out these measurements and addressing these two challenges to enable people to measure according to standardized measurement principles and carrying out the conformance testing as specified by the standardization body 3GPP.
Yes, it sounds like a very complex testing regime. Earl, how do you see Massive MIMO progressing as it rolls out over the coming years?
Right now, I think there's a significant difference that we're going to see between the sub-6 gig and, I guess, massive antenna elements for the millimeter wave. If we look at 5G new radio today in the U.S., we hear a lot about nationwide network coverage using low-band frequencies at 600 or 700 megahertz or 800 megahertz. And those are obviously not massive MIMO. Those are typically four transmit, four receive types of radios that are being transmitted through traditional passive antenna arrays. And as we get into what new T-Mobile is planning on doing now with the acquisition of Sprint being closed, I think we're going to see an accelerated rollout of coverage across the top 50 markets in the US by new T-Mobile. And that's going to be very different than the rollouts we've seen so far at millimeter wave for AT&T wireless, for US cellular, which has also done low band, or Verizon. And certainly Dish is still in the drawing boards at this point in time. I think the millimeter wave continues to have a lot of challenges because we're very low to the ground and in sub 50 feet, as opposed to being on a tower that could be several hundred feet up in the air or on a rooftop. Also, the power levels are dramatically different. You're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 to 200 watts per antenna panel for a massive MIMO sub 6 gig, as opposed to maybe up to 5 or 8 watts converted into whatever the EIRP is that the FCC will allow for a millimeter wave antenna. And so your distance, because of the line of sight on millimeter wave, is going to be dramatically reduced, and you're going to be in that 500 feet or so cell radius for millimeter wave, as opposed to hopefully several thousand feet or more for the sub 6 gig massive MIMO.
Andreas, do you have anything to add to Earl's perspective?
Yeah, I think Earl summarized it pretty nicely. I see a difference between massive MIMO and millimeter wave rollouts. For me, the millimeter wave with the reduced coverage due to the higher frequency, you see these reports out there that people get scared about nationwide rollout of millimeter wave with 700,000 new radio towers and that. I think that's bogus, if you allow me that statement. Millimeter wave is really for hotspot deployments where you need capacity, where you have dense area, a high number of people to increase capacity, you know, in stadiums, in city centers, downtown and such. Whereas I think Massive MIMO has also its benefits in the suburban, urban areas to be rolled out. So that's where the two distinguish in my eyes. And that's something that we shouldn't forget when we're discussing these two concepts.
Andreas, what's the state of the millimeter wave rollouts regionally? And especially you're concentrating on the US, they're kind of the leader in that area. So how is that panning out?
That's a good point that you bring up. I think if we divide the world into three regions like the ITU does, so there's Europe, North America, and Asia Pacific. And like you said, the US is pioneering millimeter wave and used that for the initial deployments of 5G in NSA mode. I think the rollout is progressing. If you're following the quarterly announcements from Verizon and AT&T and such, they're using 28 and 39 gigahertz. The FCC just finished auction 103 beginning of this year, auctioning off 37 and 39 gigahertz frequencies that have been hosted by the FCC. They auctioned off 47 gigahertz where Sprint and T-Mobile got licenses, where also US Cellular acquired licenses. And I think the US operators are buying into it and pushing this forward. Of course, like I said, this is not a white-based coverage. So this is only available in a number of cities where you have dense population, where you need this capacity. I think that will continue. The fixed wireless access approach is an interesting one that will play a major role in the coming months and years, I believe. And if we shift gears and looking who else is doing millimeter wave, I think we will see it in Asia next, in Korea and Japan, where a spectrum, at least in Korea, has been awarded. But also Europe is picking up pace. I just read the article that the Finnish government, the Finnish regulator, assigned millimeter wave licenses in the 26 gigahertz band. And interestingly, they set aside a spectrum for industrial IoT. So that will be interesting to see how that's going to be used and picked up by the industry and see what Finland is doing there with millimeter wave and setting some spectrum aside. So very interesting. If you have to give priorities, I think it's US pioneering it, followed by Asia. And then soon after that is, of course, Europe now interested in millimeter wave as well.
Earl, how about you? How have you seen that globally rolling out?
I think I would agree with Andreas that certainly right now that the US is in the lead, not by choice, but because it's the only spectrum we had. So we had to live with what we got and make the best of it. I think if you look at China, China's still trying to figure out exactly what they're going to do with millimeter wave. There are still ongoing field trials in China, but that's certainly going to be a huge market whenever they decide that they're going to move forward in millimeter wave. And my expectations would be similar to what the Finnish government and regulatory agencies are trying to do with Industry 4.0. I think China will probably leverage the millimeter wave more for manufacturing. And that brings the question of indoor millimeter wave and how does the industry address that? And I think, again, if you have a bunch of sensors and robots and such, do you eventually get to the point where you can do lights out manufacturing with a 5G new radio millimeter wave system that's a private network inside a manufacturing facility? But I think outdoor, South Korea and Japan obviously are areas of interest. But I would also highlight right now, from at least a mobility perspective, without the availability anywhere on the near term of an Apple iPhone that will support millimeter wave, I think that leaves a significant number of subscribers that will never be bothered to think about millimeter wave just because they're smartphone won't be able to pick up those signals. So I think that's a major issue for a lot of the operators right now in terms of how they're choosing the spectrum, is what UEs are actually going to be out there to support services and be able to generate ARPU for those operators.
Andreas, do you see millimeter wave fixed wireless access being a critical part of the 5G infrastructure, and why?
Yes, I see it that way. So I think we all know that fixed wireless access was the first application scenario that was targeted with millimeter wave by US operators, where a business model made sense. I think that hasn't changed. I think just like the transition from the pre-5G proprietary standards that were out there to be used for fixed wireless access, transitioning that over to the standardized version, 5G new radio, standardized from by 3GPP, that is taking time. I think we talked about the challenges with millimeter wave, the increased path loss and that. And I tend to believe that the operators wait for the next generation of equipment where we have the higher power classes on the network side, where we can achieve these higher powers of plus 55 dBm EIRP, which will then help to increase coverage. I think also they will wait for 3GPP release 16 features like integrated access backhaul, which means that you can use this feature to extend coverage, in particular for millimeter wave. And that will shine new light on fixed wireless access and will make it a success for sure. So that operator have now the possibility also to offer a last mile connection to customers and bundle these services like wireless, mobile wireless, and then the last mile, which they all have in their business model. So that's why it will play a critical role from my perspective.
So Earl, I know you have some concerns about the value of millimeter wave rollouts, and I know you've done some actual walking around the field and looking what's there. What have you seen?
Right now, I think the siting remains a major issue. The latest reports that we just published today, actually, Pat, for the cities of Dallas, Texas, and Providence, Rhode Island, kind of highlight something that isn't on everyone's radar, which is the majority of those particular sites are being deployed on wooden utility poles that a city typically doesn't have jurisdiction over, but the local electrical utility does. So for a mobile operator such as Verizon or AT&T or anyone else, even though they may have an agreement with a city, they would still need to have then separate agreements with the utility companies to, in order to get onto those wooden poles, because those are in areas where, again, for fixed wireless access, I want to be close to the end user, whether it's an apartment building or a condominium complex, or even for an enterprise such as a hospital and such that are looking for internet services and broadband wireless services. So I think that's continuing to be a challenge. I think the advent of potentially repeaters now is going to hopefully help extend that cell site, get the radio hopefully onto a rooftop. I would imagine that off-air repeaters are going to be needed to pump the signal inside every Verizon store if they hope to sell a phone. At some point, if that store doesn't have 5G coverage, I think it'll make it very difficult for them to argue the case of someone buying a 5G UE for AT&T and T-Mobile as well. So I think you're going to have different classes of repeaters that are going to be coming online. And then the one ugly thing that no one's really addressing right now is how do we get that inside a building? And do we even start talking about millimeter wave DAS at this point in time, or we focus more on the 5G NR 2.5 gigahertz that T-Mobile is certainly going to want to have inside the majority of buildings? And I know some DAS companies are already coming out with their 5G NR radio modules that could be upgrading their existing DAS systems to provide, again, 2.5 gig 5G NR signals inside stadiums and other places so that T-Mobile can leverage their additional bandwidth that they have. I think right now on millimeter wave, again, it's still very, very spotty, and the deployments are very much focused on fixed wireless, even though it's an EMBB network. Where you see the sites are next to buildings that you would ideally like to deploy fixed wireless access services, and you're not really hoping that someone will be walking around on the sidewalk with a UE and being able to connect to the network.
Earl, earlier you talked about the U.S. starting 5G deployment at millimeter wave because we have that spectrum available and don't really have sub-6 gigahertz spectrum available yet. If you look at other regions in the world, they seem to choose sub-6 gigahertz. Would you say that was because the spectrum is available, or was it driven more by use cases?
I think if you look at most countries outside of the U.S., when they were awarded their spectrum, they were awarded both a chunk of the 3.5 gigahertz, which is typical for sub-6 gig, and they were also awarded millimeter wave licenses in tandem. So most operators who have 5G spectrum have both millimeter wave and sub-6 gig, and obviously we've seen them deploy primarily on the sub-6 gig. they focused really on the consumer use case at this point for mobile broadband. But I certainly believe what we may find out is that a killer app for millimeter wave may be indoor industrial manufacturing applications, as opposed to outdoor fixed wireless with self-install CPEs, et cetera, that you don't need to truck roll to get a user online for your network. And I think we're going to start seeing some of those applications, and maybe sub-6 gig will still have indoor for manufacturing as well. It all depends on, would I rather have 800 megahertz or 400 megahertz of channel bandwidth to run all my robots and machinery as opposed to only 100 megahertz of bandwidth that I would have in the below-6 gig.
Andreas, what's your view of other regions choosing to go with sub-6 gigahertz first for 5G deployment? Spectrum availability or more use case driven?
It's a little bit of both, I would say. I would agree on the fact that in the United States, it was the spectrum that has been made available to operators or had been acquired through acquisitions. We need to take that step back to when originally millimeter wave was intended for fixed wireless access only, and these proprietary 5G standards have been developed. What the idea was is that on a last mile connection, the target was to do gigabit per second speeds. Fiber to the home to compete with these vendors is expensive. I think the carriers learned their lesson. I think fiber to the premises kind of survived somehow, but then you are limited in the speed offerings that you can bring to the home. So the alternative for the carriers that couldn't do fiber to the home nor premises was going wireless. And finding more bandwidth was the easy answer, is go up in frequency, right? And that was the major business model and use case at that time to, in my opinion, to have the option to bundle mobile wireless and then offer also internet at your house, which we all typically benefit from. These millimeter wave bands was, in my eyes, like regulatory, not awarded in that sense, no auction. Verizon acquired a company and acquired the licenses and used that spectrum. And only after that, an auction followed for 28 and 39 gigahertz, where we see some licenses consolidated to make it more affordable and applicable from a technical point of view to aggregate these carriers and create these wider data pipes to create the gigabit per second experience for fixed wireless access. The challenge was then and is to bring that into phones and use that. That will only come into play if you think about like the Starbucks around your corner where a lot of people sit and make that their office, at least before the pandemic. And they're always sharing the Wi-Fi point there, Wi-Fi access point there. And of course, that has a certain capacity and there are certain limitations there. And in that sense, you know, if that area is covered by a remote radio head with millimeter wave and you have that in your smartphone / PC, that would be beneficial and could prevent a use case for mobile millimeter wave, if you allow me that term. So I think here in the US, it was driven by business needs and then followed by regulation. I think the sub-6 gigahertz, 3.5 gigahertz deployments in the rest of the world, is, in my opinion, the spectrum was available. It was underutilized. We see different use in technology in Asia, North America versus Europe. In Europe, a lot of folks still looking for the next free Wi-Fi hotspot and using that rather than connecting through cellular. We have data consumption here in the US and Asia being high. So more spectrum was needed. A lot of the sub-6, well, all of the sub-6 gigahertz spectrum, in my opinion, is heavily utilized by LTE. So there was just nothing available and no auction on the horizon. And that forced, especially in North America, operators to look for millimeter wave in the first place, unless they had acquired spectrum, were allowed to participate in auctions to acquire low band spectrum and such. So it's a combination of a lot of factors. While we see what we see in the 5G era right now with sub-6 gigahertz deployments, mostly in the rest of the world and millimeter wave in the United States.
So Andreas, as part of a test company, you kind of get a glimpse of what's coming. So when do we expect handsets to actually have millimeter wave technology in them?
Good question. We basically have it since a year now commercialized. So with the launch of these networks, the first generation of devices has been launched with a limited set of features, as we can see across the blog posts from tech bloggers and all that. Meanwhile, we are at the, if I not mistaken, the third generation of antenna array systems that are being offered by chipset makers that can be integrated by OEMs into their handsets. So it shrank even further, been optimized in power consumption and such. So we are optimizing still. We have to introduce additional features to even optimize it further. There's room for improvement, but handsets already incorporate millimeter wave today. And speeds that we see at 1.8 gigabit per second in commercial available handsets, when you are in coverage, I have to point that out still, the speeds are there. But typically these people are also the only users on that particular cell because it's not like widely adopted yet. But handsets are there and we can achieve these data speeds in commercial networks. And of course, the optimization will continue over the next years to maturize millimeter wave technology in mobile handsets.
Earl, how about you? What are your projections for wide use of millimeter wave in mobile devices?
Pat, I think one thing, just to backtrack a little bit, if we look at the country north of us in Canada, they don't have the same restrictions as we do here in the US. So certainly there's no push for millimeter wave up in Canada at this point, since they will be able to leverage the sub 6 gig spectrum that they will have access to, whether it's that 2.5 gigahertz or 3.5 gigahertz, depending on what bands are available up there. But they're not going to be essentially stuck like we are here in the US. So they will have a much different deployment scenario up in Canada, probably for the first time from a North American perspective, and they will be diverging from what the US is doing. I think if we look at handsets right now, again, you're making a phone because you want to have a certain number of units that are going to be sold. So every phone manufacturer has to make the decision from an R&D and cost perspective as to how many models are they going to have and what features. And right now, I think everything is obviously Android only, and we're still waiting for Apple. And if we're trying to, at least if the mobile operators are trying to target the sub 30-year-old mobile subscriber out there in the US, then they're going to need to have an Apple phone. Otherwise, they will never touch that demographic, more than likely. So I put my son into that same category, and I don't think he'll ever buy a phone that isn't an Apple phone. So if it's not in an Apple phone, then probably half the US won't be doing anything in millimeter wave anytime before mid-2021, more than likely, and maybe even later than that, depending on what Apple decides that they want to do. So right now, I think everything is very hinged on Apple's decision and their strategy as to how they incorporate millimeter wave. The other issue becomes, outside of Qualcomm, who else has a chipset with the millimeter wave and the antenna is integrated? And is there anyone else on the horizon, or is everything going to be dependent on Qualcomm to provide that technology as we move forward?
Andreas, earlier we talked about test challenges with sub 6 gigahertz. Let's switch now to millimeter wave. What are the test challenges there?
Yeah, the question is very much related to massive MIMO as well. Here we talked a little bit more about the base station side. So I would like to shift gears and stick to the device. Also here, we will be using an OTA setup. So the same rules apply, how we create far field conditions. We also utilizing here compact antenna test ranges, which means using reflector to create a quiet zone that the device can fit into. I think the challenges comes along with mobility in millimeter wave, where we, of course, need to provide signals from different angle of arrivals and being able to test this functionality in terms of beam management, beam refinement, and such. So those methodologies are, according to my understanding, still under discussion in 3GPP, RAN 4 and RAN 5. There will be, of course, there's parts available, but you know, not 100% yet finished that work. And that is something that we as an industry still continue to work on to make this an affordable test scenario for performance testing for devices in terms of mobility, in terms of radio resource management. So this is one of the challenges that I see still pending over ahead, and that we have to address and to solve as an industry as a whole.
Thank you, Andreas and Earl, for your insightful thoughts. We will continue the discussion on 5G in the next episode, where we'll cover how releases 16 and 17 will enable the IoT. We want to thank Rohden Schwartz for sponsoring this series and encourage you to visit their website for more information on 5G. including a free ebook and an educational video series called Demystifying 5G. Thanks for listening, and we hope you're finding this series informational.